Yeah, I think I'm going to start coming back.
Patrick?
Yes?
You ready to go?
Sure.
Can you set up, I need, where you got to start? Hello, man, how you doing?
Computer works on power cord.
What?
Everyone's computer works on power cord.
Oh, it does, it just rapidly runs out of, juice. Mine's older, but fortunately I have nothing on here, it's just my, the pair of strap I wear up.
That's fine.
Yeah. Of course, I don't think I'll proffer some of the more radical arguments, like that bicycle should be outlawed entirely.
And people would be.
Got a good sympathetic. It's about unity.
That's a good point.
Are we going?
We can be.
Okay. So.
So, you know.
Yes.
Name, rank, and serial.
I'm Patrick Duffy, 3L at the law school. Serial number 04612GXL.
John Lobb, 3L, serial number pending.
Our argument, our project basically is about bikers in bicyclers, and I guess, you know, Vespa scooter drivers in Cambridge. And we noticed that Cambridge is basically in the grip of a two-wheeled terror. Bicyclers are everywhere these days, and they are unbelievably dangerous. They seem to operate on their own set of norms that kind of inhabits a gray area between pedestrians and between motorists, so that they ride on the roads and the sidewalks. They sort of vaguely obey traffic laws. They seem to be treating, say, for example, red lights as maybe like a stop sign. From what I've seen of bicyclers in Cambridge especially, is that they're really sort of, their actions are circumscribed only by their kind of vague and damaged sense of self-preservation. And what we hope to do in this project is to change all that, to make the roads and the sidewalks of Cambridge a safe place for, you know, pedestrians, families, dogs, pretty much, you know, lessen the catastrophic death toll that bikers have wreaked on our community.
How high is the death toll? Catastrophically high?
Catastrophically high, I would say.
Higher than deaths from online poker, as far as we know.
What was that, yeah?
The death toll from bicycles is higher than the death toll from online poker, as far as we know.
So, What we're hoping to do is, first of all, to educate those who ride bicycles, you know, what things look like from the perspective of a pedestrian who's fleeing for their life, or a motorist who stands to be liable for, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars if they accidentally, you know, tap a bicycler with their car, as they're so often tempted to do. And also to educate people who must live in a community that has bicyclers. If, you know, if bicycles must be legal, then we should understand how the bicycler's mentality works. What they think, why they feel that they're above the law, and how basically to deal with that. We also hope to contact local law enforcement and hope to, disabuse the law enforcement of the myth that the bicycler is harmless, that they, I think that the reason that there's so little enforcement is because bicyclers are perceived to be relatively harmless, that they, you know, can do very little damage, and therefore there isn't as much of a need to enforce laws against them, whereas a car can, you know, cause a 15 car pileup and result in deaths of at least two or three people. But what nobody realizes is that bicycles can do that as well, and do pretty much on a daily basis. So our main goal is education and awareness about the bicycle scourge. And fostering education and understanding among everyone who must share the roads and the sidewalks.
So now, has John got a piece of this as well?
Yes, right. He's yeah, talking about implementation.
So we think that the sort of the best way to get this argument or issue out there is probably through some sort of website that, you know, you could go onto, and it would have information about laws that bicyclers have to obey. It would also have information for, you know, the pedestrian who's constantly the victim of bicycle terror, and sort of make them aware that bicyclers aren't going to just change their behavior, you know, because there are laws out there, that they have to sort of be active as well in confronting bicyclers about, not obeying the laws. You know, we think that bicyclers, while they may seem very courageous in the face of no resistance, would be equally cowardly if someone were to say, you know, hey, this is a sidewalk, not a side bicycle, or something like that. We would also, you know, on the website sort of encourage people to, you know, get together somehow. We haven't really worked that out yet, and sort of discuss, you know, why bicyclers don't obey the laws and why pedestrians feel like they are, you know, at risk from bicyclers. And I think the website would also probably have a petition on there that if you wanted to, you could sign it to send to, you know, the city of Cambridge or someone to, you know, more strictly enforce the laws that do exist, because we think that bicyclers, you know, all they care about is their precious money. So if they, if they had to pay a fine, then we think they might start thinking twice about riding on the sidewalks and not obeying traffic laws.
So is this meant to be a parody, or is this meant to be for real?
I think it contains elements of both. anybody who travels in Cambridge on a regular basis will see bicyclers swerving insanely, you know, in heavy traffic, and probably assaulting old women and other things of the sort.
Is there any empathy in your argument for the cyclist? Your attitude seems to be entirely hostile.
We've tried to feel empathy for the cyclists, and we think that maybe with some by talking to members of that community, we might be able to gain a window into the psyche of the bicyclist.
Which mode of talking to them is to threaten them with various deterrent.
We think the first move maybe has to come from people who are aggrieved by bicyclers, and then, you know, that might get the ball rolling. Then bicyclers can.
Because it may be true that bicyclers also see themselves as harmless. That that if you run into something with a bicycle, it usually doesn't cause very much damage. And for that reason, the bicycler may see themselves as less threatening than, say, a car or a 16-wheel truck or a larger piece of metal.
All right, the floor is open for questions from the class.
So I'm curious as to why there weren't, I guess, involving the pedestrians or the drivers. It seems like in Boston, pedestrians and drivers also don't really obey any traffic laws. I mean, and just generally, like, when I'm walking, I want to kill drivers. When I'm driving, I want to kill pedestrians. When I'm on a bike, you know.
You want to kill everyone, and that's exactly what we're trying to get at.
But, no, I mean, seriously, I don't know that I feel like pedestrians all the time jump in front of cars, and there's not a crosswalk, and cars always like drive through stop signs here all the time.
Well, I think you have a point, especially in Harvard Square, which is really sort of the focal point for traffic law violations, I think, in the United States. And I think that would make it the perfect forum for this for this type of discussion.
And we think that's probably a point that might come, you know, bicyclers might say, well, why should we obey any laws if pedestrians don't think they have to obey, you know, jaywalking laws or whatever. And, you know, that might be sort of a mutual agreement eventually. I don't know.
The fact maybe that cyclists are allowed on sidewalks in Massachusetts, and I mean, as long as they don't go something like faster than average walking speed, I don't see anything crazy about that. But the idea is you're meant to share the sidewalk between pedestrians and cyclists. So is the idea maybe you have to find a better way of sharing the sidewalk rather than saying cyclists belong on the road with the cars, which cyclists often see as a very dangerous place to be, particularly in bad conditions.
Sure. Well, one of the problems that cyclists face is that, you know, there really is no specific medium in which they're supposed to be operating their machines, but, you know, except for the bike paths, which really aren't meant for getting anywhere in particular. It's sort of this, the scenic driving type thing. And I think that coming to a decision on the type of norms that would be best for bicyclists may be something that comes out of this entire discussion.
Yeah, because even with bike lanes, I mean, I don't ride a bike, but I don't think I'd feel particularly safe riding in a bike lane, given that, you know, parked cars could open their doors, or, you know, cars driving on the road could easily just run you off the the road.
It depends on the driving, like, it depends, and you get loads of bike lanes everywhere, and they're much safer than on the road. But obviously that means you have to educate the drivers, and actually has nothing to do with pedestrians in the end, whether or not the cyclists feel safe. So it's kind of, I guess I was going to say, you've got to educate drivers as well as pedestrians and cyclists, right? That conflict may appear to be there, but actually you can solve it somewhere else.
Right. Yeah, I think like part of the you know, informative like bike law section would be to also educate, you know, drivers, bike, you know, people on bicycles do have rights to be on the road, or they do have rights to, you know, whatever.
You might also want to include a section on tort law, say who's liable in these types of situations.
Yes.
Any other questions? Yes.
Have you thought about like how you can improve the Cambridge area to be more bike friendly? Because I feel like that would solve a lot of the problems. If you look at like a city like Tucson, Arizona, they're extremely bike friendly, and they have like they pass laws that all new roads have to have bike lanes. They're usable all roads, and I feel like my boyfriend's a semi-professional cyclist, so I get lots of bicycles and stuff. And he always gets really pissed off when people don't follow the rules, because it's really dangerous for the cyclists themselves, because you get hit by a car, and, you know, anyone who's been a cyclist for a very long time, eventually you get hit by a car, and that's no good. And, you know, it's just rude. And I think that there's a huge part of the cycling community that would just dox people who follow these rules. So, I mean, I don't think you should look at it as, like, all cyclists are just, like, wanting to mow down pedestrians, because that's definitely not the goal of what I know of the cycling community. Most people just want to be able to, you know, use their mode of transportation safely and conveniently, and would like to follow the rules and the laws if
we
could work together.
I think that's an excellent goal, to foster peace and reconciliation between bicyclers and pedestrians.
But a practical approach, Patrick, you obviously like a kind of a cutting style, it's an element of humor, and when you're thinking about what's interesting or what would make this issue interesting, it's clear that you're feeling that some of that vitriol, said with a smile, is stylistically attractive.
I think it's a possibility. I think.
But the challenge, though, would seem to be for you to do it in a way that actually expressed empathy for the cyclists, who, from their point of view, are in an incredibly hostile environment.
Well, and that the strategy there may be to sort of use that style of voice as a way of perhaps diffusing the differences between bikers and pedestrians.
So do you think that your web strategy has any chance at all of success, John?
I think it might
get... What would draw people to it?
Well, I think we could start by sort of like posting, flyers around like school where people, you know...
So to explain the psyche of the person who's interested enough to go, why are they going?
Because they're like us and they're angry that bicyclers are constantly trying to run them over, or they feel that way anyway, even if they're not. Also, I think, putting flyers on...
Your audience is people who are angry at bikers.
Partly. Also, bikers who see, sort of inflammatory signs and say, hey, that's not right, and, they want to go see why somebody thinks that way.
Yeah, I think one strategy may be just to sort of... to make as outrageous claims as we can possibly think, and then have people come to find out whether or not they're true. And of course, most of them will be. But some of them may be slight exaggerations of an already tense situation.
All right. Oh, Andrew, you have something?
Do you think an effective strategy would be to create media, like videos or something, satirical type short YouTube videos, but then also have a biting element to the truthiness, if you will?
Yeah, I thought of that. I think that's a good idea.
Like just throwing out this, video evidence of these terrors.
We're all about truthiness in this project.
Any project that has the essence of truth.
How do you plan to theoretically publicize this to the Cambridge community and get the word out, because there's a lot of websites out there that I've never seen.
We could hold a protest of some sort. We know people from Cambridge like protests and signs.
Only if they shut down traffic patterns, though.
Yes, and as well as bike traffic patterns.
Exactly.
So that everybody can, if rage is created among the motorist community, we can harness that for our purposes.
I really think it's most effective to try to be sympathetic to them too, because I remember they made an anti-left walking committee last year, and they're on Facebook. It was kind of joking. I think people were really annoyed that people walk on the left side of the sidewalk. But eventually people got really mad, because they were like, some people are from countries where people drive on the left side of the road. This is extremely, and so it might backfire if, you're not kind of coming at it from...
What you're saying is there could be roaming bands of bicycle vigilantes.
Yes.
Extracting cruel justice from the pedestrian community.
Yes, and also you should start a Facebook.
You could also be the person who articulates the other side. So you could have even say... You pretend to be a cyclist to show you understand, so you could use the same biting satire, cyclists talking about pedestrians. Because in that way you can then posit yourself as slightly more neutral, even though you get to be cutting about both sides. And that might be where not alienating as many people.
Have you heard of any of the bicycle clubs?
Well, we know there's
guys that get together, and riders that get together. Shouldn't you say it's all guys? It's not.
There's one group called Mass Bike that has a website where they posted relevant laws for Massachusetts bikers and have described sort of nice bike routes.
It's like a place to get free bike equipment and stuff like that. I think the Bush administration identified it as a terrorist group, though.
All right, you guys. Fair enough. You're excused.
Thank you.
So am I right? We have nobody else that's ready to go forward here?
I'll be better tomorrow.
Yeah, you're on this. You're on the.
I mean,
it's not tomorrow. That's okay. That's all right.
I can go today.
Is it okay if I just... I did the work and you put myself on the
bed. Sure, put yourself on. Absolutely. So no cake before it's time. What's that saying? What is it you're not supposed to do before it's time? Do something. Anyway, I don't want to rush you. We have interesting things we can talk about. We were slash dotted on RIAA. Does that mean anything to anybody besides David?
It's no wine before it's time.
No wine before it's time, there you go. Yes, the RI, somebody find it?
Yeah.
And it leads to a very nice story, which basically says that 7 out of 8 Ivy League schools have been hit by RIAA lawsuits to students, but oddly Harvard has not been hit. And why can that be so? What explains this? And they actually attribute it to an aggressive litigation stance advocated by the William F. Weld Professor of Law in the Berkman Center. That's kind of good. Then I have a model document, which I would love you to take a look at, relating to the RIAA lawsuit and the attempt to put out some kind of like op-ed kind of a statement by a group. We'll talk about that. And I'm very eager to recommend a book to you. And the line of thought that it represents, I'm curious whether you've come across it otherwise in your law school career. Have you come across a book by Randy Kennedy called The Presumption of Liberty? It's a very interesting argument that's made. I've been thinking about it for a number of reasons, but one of them is that I'm in the process of planning my winter evidence class. And my winter evidence class, I should say, it looks like it may have a kind of major Cyber One component to it, in the sense that we have the opportunity to produce it together with Council Connect. Council Connect is a corporate enterprise that started some 6 years ago by Michael Breyer, who's Judge Stephen Breyer's son, delivering technology to courtrooms, basically putting the courtroom on the web for purposes of facilitating the litigation. And It established great relationships with many courts and has now established a joint relationship with Court TV so that it has complete access to all the Court TV archives of trials for educational use, and has merged with a company called Audio Case File, which is the company that's been into developing other more interesting ways than a textbook of conveying legal materials to law students. So, for example, the idea that the cases you read in law school can be on audio tape so that you can be climbing the stair machine or doing whatever else you're doing. And just basically other ways of delivering material. So the idea of collaborating with this group in recording an evidence class and streaming it to the web in a distance learning environment seems to be on the table as a kind of beta test of the technology and the economics and pedagogy. So I've been thinking about the evidence class. And the idea of the class has to do with what I imagine to be the fundamental constitutional problem. If you imagine an idealized environment in which free people who are self-actualized in the sense of having their liberty and appreciating it come together as individuals and form a government, a constitution, a contract for how they can function as a community in ways that will benefit themselves. And facing the dilemma that people who make governments have always faced, that in turning over one's, in exposing one's precious liberty to the competition of government, you're doing something exceedingly dangerous, because the government both sets the rules for the future and interprets them. And so as you imagine sitting around, just imagine yourselves somehow as superheroes in an environment in which you have achieved some kind of mastery and individual freedom. It's like you've succeeded in building your ranch in the frontier or whatever. And you're coming together on the proposition that working together somehow and ceding some liberties together, you can get much more out of life and can do it without losing your essential liberties. How do you go forward from that point to build a government that gives you the best guarantee into the future that your liberties will be preserved and appreciated? That's really the constitutional dilemma. And the evidence class starts from John Adams' analysis, really, that the two great connections to liberty in the United States Constitution are the power of the people to elect the legislature and the executive, power of vote, in other words, and the power of the jury, participation in the jury. So the thought is that between those two, you have some hope that liberties will continue to be appreciated into the future. And when you look at the history of evolution of those ideas since the founding of our Constitution, you see them getting compromised. The first rule of evidence that I want to address is one that turns on the history of the jury as the arbiter of the facts only, as opposed to the arbiter of the law and the facts. That is, the original idea with jury was that you could make your argument to a jury, and your argument could include the unfairness of the law as well as the inapplicability of the facts. And this was a tremendous form of constraint on the government, getting out of touch with the people. The idea, from the point of view of the liberty framers, of having some ability in the process of the law to make argument directly to the people, in some way depends on it. It took about 100 years, and eventually the courts decided that it was no longer allowed for lawyers to argue law to the jury. You had to take the law from the court. And so no matter how unjust a law might be, a man couldn't defend against an assertion that he was guilty by arguing the unfairness of the law. So along comes this book written by Randy Kennedy, which kind of tells this story and articulates a presumption in favor of liberty and would offset that presumption against the presumptions that the courts developed later of deference to the legislature. So for example, the presumption of rationality accorded to legislative enactions is a tremendous concession of power to the legislature. And of course, going back to the liberty situation, what people worried about liberty into the future worry about is some form of dominant strand in a community which takes over a majority and asserts that for some reason individual liberties have to be curtailed. So the idea of actually introducing the subject as the story of liberty and of introducing the law of evidence as the constraints on how one can make an argument for liberty and how some of the rules attempt to protect one's liberty in making argument. That's the frame of the class. So I recommend this book to you. I brought it to show you.
Here it is, a nice paperback. Restoring the Lost Constitution by Randy Barnett. He went on, interestingly, after this book was published, to represent plaintiffs in the medical marijuana case that went to the United States Supreme Court, Raich, in, I think it was 2006, lost 6-3, but basically attempting to expand on, in a sense, the arguments of Lawrence versus Texas, in which the Supreme Court holds the state back from criminalizing sodomy in between consenting adults in the home. But, I'm interested in this. I like in a class to have a case. And this year I'm really looking forward to having this marijuana case because I think that the opportunities it offers for a kind of hands-on clinical engagement with the process of the law and the relationship of jury the rules of evidence and practice in front of it are all quite terrific and potentially engaging.
What are you representing then? What part of it? Is it just defending?
I'm representing a guy named Keith Stroop.
I know. Are you just defending them against the charges? Or what is your representation?
Well, on December 7th, I'll appear with him at the arraignment. As I read it, we're entitled to a jury trial in front of a jury of six. I should have Matt Feinberg representing his co-defendant. And I hope a nice team of lawyers working with us. And we are looking to challenge on any number of grounds. But where the objective is, in effect, to take the position of someone who deeply believes in the need for the reform of marijuana laws. My defendant is the founder of the National organization for the reform of marijuana laws, and who resents that the law requires him to keep secret his exercise of liberty. He clearly regards smoking marijuana as a personal liberty and can't see that he does any harm to anyone by doing it, and would like to be able to assert that a law that prevents him from doing that is irrational in a number of respects. Irrational in the sense of there being no harm and benefit to the individual, irrational in the sense of being inequitable in relationship to other laws like alcohol, for example. He would like to be able to make that representation to the jury, which raises this question of, is it possible to argue the fairness of the law? And he would like as well to make an argument that the law itself should be limited by the presumption of liberty, that in dealing with a liberty, the rational basis test and the various equally diluted formulations of necessary and proper should take on a real sense of rationality rather than this sort of abstracted, obsequious form of rationality where the judges are able to say, well, it really doesn't make sense to me, but I can't say that it wouldn't make sense to somebody, kind of an approach. So, should prove. I hope you'll be interested.
Is he facing jail time?
Sorry?
Is the defendant, are either of them facing potential jail time if they go to trial and lose?
Right? No. The only way, my understanding at this point, I haven't actually interviewed either one of them directly yet. My understanding is that neither one has a prior offense, that the quantity was one marijuana cigarette, and the statute indicates that a mandatory probation, if the defendants accept it, but if they don't, then they're subject to punishment in a house of confinement for up to 6 months and a fine. So there's some interest in the play in the statute about whether they would choose to accept it, what that would mean, and so forth. Yes, I was worrying today that I hadn't asked you to read enough material, that somehow in a course there should be a reading list and you should be reading things on a regular basis. And we've done some reading as we go along sporadically. But I was looking also at a piece of work by Judith Donair, which I bet if you Google you would find. It's called, it's got real in the title, two words, being real, I think. And I was thinking that if I had it to do over again, I would have had you reading that somewhere early on, because it's about this interface of real and virtual that the Cyber One idea plays with. She's a, I don't know what you would quite call her academically. She's a signal theorist. She's into how people communicate with each other and very much into the subliminal communications. It's like she's a master of tells. She's really into the ways in which people convey trust or reliability or any number of human attributes by the ways in which they conduct themselves, often unaware. And then she's particularly interested in what happens in online environments where you can limit the ways in which people communicate, and still you are looking for making some kinds of meaningful connections. And so she's very much into the study of signaling, given the opportunities for signaling, and the structuring of environments that facilitate constructive signaling. It's interesting stuff. It leads back. It's actually a form, in an interesting way, of the Turing test. Yeah, are you all familiar with the Turing test? Turing was a mathematician and conceptualist who, amongst other amazing things like breaking the German codes in the Second World War and more or less inventing the computer along with Neumann, articulates the Turing test about, well, it's interesting what it's about. He invents the Turing machine. The Turing test is whether you can tell that something is human by interacting with it, as a definition of machine intelligence. And in a sense, that's interesting as an abstraction. You know, it's like thinking about what is intelligence. But in its way, it's also what I'm asking you to think about here from the other side as an element of Cyber One. Because when you're using code and the digital environment to communicate, in some sense, you're touching on the possibilities of creating symbols that you send out that produce the particular response you want, and in some sense coding the machine to do it. So for example, the question comes up in online poker: are you playing against a robot? And what difference does it make to you? Why should it make a difference? That when you are dealing online, do you have a sense that you're dealing with a person as opposed to a machine? Often you do, but can you be sure? And what is it that makes you sure when you think you're dealing with a person? And what difference does it make to you? That's a fascinating question in the open net with all the complications. It's a fascinating question in the diminished, controlled environment that you can create with games. So the question is just as relevant with online poker in a way that would seem to make it more subject to study than in the wide open net environment, and yet highly relevant to it. In some sense, I'm hoping to convey with this class is the potential of thinking about that from the message-making side, so that you, in a sense, become able to use the communication space, both by implanting message in it and by designing it. That is, thinking in terms of both the message and the context, the space and the metaspace, and having some command over both. So Andrew and I are going to Google on Thursday of this week. And Google turns out to be Google University. They actually use that term. and they invited us to come and speak. And the invitation is extraordinary in one respect. They refuse to pay transportation. You have to pay your own way to go out there to speak to them. No honorarium. You go for the privilege of speaking to them, and you pay your way across the country to do it. Now, how do you react to that? What is the message? Why would they conceivably do that? What do they want? How does one respond to that message? What is the message? Anybody offended by that? If you were invited to go speak, then you say, oh, God, that's exciting. I'd love to speak there. Are you paying coach or business class? Yeah, no, we're not paying anything. Yeah?
The fact that it's a non-profit that's kind of being asked to go speak at a for-profit company, to me, seems a little, like, if it were a non-profit that was inviting you to come speak, then in that context, I would see, you know, if they're not willing to pay, is a little bit more reasonable position. But the fact that they're, you know, one of the biggest companies, you know, by value in the United States, and they're inviting, you know, you as nonprofit representatives of an idea, and then are unwilling to kind of help you financial side of it, seems to me to be just,
seems kind of small.
It's,
seems kind of petty.
Yeah.
Designed just to piss people off. Either not come at all out of pique. Or if you come, first thing you're going to say is take a shot at him. What do you think, Jihad?
Kind of along his lines about being, because I think for like Harvard, I'm part of a CECL, and we're always trying to get people to come here, invite them to come. And one of the restraints is that we can only fly people out here coach. We can't fly them out business class. And for some people, that's a deal breaker, because they only want to fly business class or better. And so for someone to, like, I can't even imagine trying to get someone to come out. And you would think, you know, Harvard's a pretty big name in itself. I mean, Google, you know, they're great now too. Google University is the number one ranked school in the country. It's an actual company. Whereas Harvard seems to have more of an educational, intellectual lore to it. And even we sometimes can't get some of the big names to come out, let alone on their own dime to come here. So, I mean, if they can get people to do it, obviously, good for them, but for me it seems it kind of astounds me a little.
I will say one thing just quickly in Google's defense. Their initial email said, I see you guys have some activity in Northern California. We'd be delighted to have you come talk on your next trip out to California. They didn't just send an email out of the blue that said, like, come here and come talk. They at least tried to have the pretense of saying, when you're in California anyways, come talk. So that, I guess, is the only thing I can say for them.
Uh-huh.
What'd you get for your cash? You go, I mean, what's, what are they giving? Just,
what are they giving back?
Yeah.
I mean, why am I going?
Yeah.
That seems to me to be the right question. That seems to me to be the right question, yeah?
You can get a lot of good food there.
A lot of good food, yeah.
Google pastry chef, so.
Yeah, yeah. Terrible. Man on a diet. Cholesterol problems. Have you got any skim milk, you know, that's like that? It's like, oh, I'm not going for the food.
You can make your own cappuccinos there.
Too. That's really great.
I think that's the other thing, is that they give so many perks to their employees that it almost seems worse that, you know, they're not offering to fly you out.
Uh-huh.
You know, they have on-site massage therapists.
Uh-huh.
Have you tried asking if they'll fly you out?
Yeah.
Just call them and say, please.
No, we sent email. They made it perfectly clear. Then you're put to it. Are you going or aren't you? You're going to pay the money out of your own damn pocket to go out there and talk to these people?
Can you get Harvard to pay for it?
I probably could get Harvard to pay for it.
There you go. Win-win situation for you and Google.
I mean, I can probably figure out some way to get somebody to pay for it.
I mean, are there typical speakers people from the Valley, or have they been getting people from all over? Because that would make sense if they had that policy, if it was mostly Valley people speaking it.
What their response was is I sent them an email that said basically, these are the travel arrangements that Professor is making. We're planning on coming out at this point for this long. What's your policy regarding providing for transportation arrangements, et cetera? We can't. They want us to talk at like 1 p.m. in the afternoon on Thursday. There's no flight that gets out there early enough that day to talk, so we have to stay overnight. What's their policy regarding? I want to coordinate regarding the schedule for the day, regarding Google's policy in terms of providing for transportation arrangements, et cetera. That's my email to her. The response is, Google does not provide for speaker transportation, but you can get a Google discounted rate of participating in nearby hotels. Call to make a reservation and ask for the Google rate, or we can help you make, or we can make the reservation for you. And it lists the number of hotels. And then it suggests that there are plenty of shared van shuttles that you can take from the airport to the hotel, and the hotel could call you a cab to get to Google's campus. But renting a car may be easier for you.
They're saving us money all the way.
That was essentially the response to our request. Now, when we didn't push it, maybe we should have. With the Thanksgiving holiday and stuff. This communication came on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. There we go.
So suppose you were going out to Google. What would be your mission? And why am I going to Google? Google, you should know, has a foundation that has a ton of money in it.
Who are you speaking to? Like a group?
It's totally unclear to me who we're speaking to.
Apparently what we're doing is, apparently Google has these talks and they advertise on their campus to other departments and stuff and various things, and they make it optional for their employees to come to it. So I don't know from what I've gathered from their emails that they even know exactly who will come from their various departments and stuff. But I've seen that whoever's interested, apparently.
Is this, because you see like this, like Simon Sharma did a talk there just about one of his books, and I'm seeing like they've got a video on that. Is it that kind of thing? Like just?
I really don't know. It sure sounds like an employee enrichment program of some kind.
It seems like the sort of value you may be able to get out of it is that if you can go there and sort of excite five people at Google about what you're doing, and these people are smart or influential or in some way can help out, that might itself be worth it if you can. But I think that sort of the takeaway from that would be that if you go there, you just say, well, here's what we're doing, here's how you can help, and maybe five people will email you and say, yeah, we'd like to help. And if you have that in mind, like maybe you should think about that in advance. Like what could someone at Google do to help advance the interests of, you know, online poker or the in general the
what exactly is Google University? I mean, is it referring to like these products that they're putting out?
We know practically nothing about it. If anything you can turn up on the web.
Yeah.
And then there's this one guy who does, I remember seeing a video that was filmed at Google, and I think he does it for a website about, I think it's like personal productivity or something like that. He went and gave a talk, and his big selling point is he shows, you can watch his video when he was at Google, telling Google about these things. Google thought it was important enough that they videoed him doing it, which I guess is, at the very, very least, that's what you can get. I assume they might well do the same thing, they might well video it, and they should let you say you're at Google, they're still enough to do it, but that can be a valuable thing to get out of it, just the fact you can have your argument be shown at Google, and just you can leech off some of their supposed goodness.
Partly isn't good enough, I gotta go to Google.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a very different environment, that you get a lot of respect from people from Google.
do in a different sense, you would get Harvard.
Yeah, that's true.
Academic
Along those lines, from a publicity standpoint, does it do anything for your organization, or does, like, does the perception of the organization change if you're focused, if you're talking, if your engagements are all university-based versus the things you're doing are university-based and also industry-based, or you're doing things? Is there a difference in the perception of an organization that has done events at Harvard, UCLA, Michigan, or Harvard, UCLA, Michigan, and Google? Does that change the perception?
And who cares? I mean, one of the things that I'm curious about is there anything, imagine yourself, you're there at Google, and you're listening. One kind of thing you can listen to is like Simon Sharma talking about his stuff, and it was enriching, and it was a nice way to spend an hour. Another way to listen is you listen and you come to understand something more about the environment that you think and work about. So somehow you learn something about internet space, cyberspace, game space, whatever it is, and you get a little takeaway from that, so that's a plus. Another would be that somehow they might see in what we're doing some corporate advantage through association of some kind. It seems that only if one succeeds in the third do you have much basis for asking them for anything. And it seems, why go unless I'm going to ask them for something?
Google has a thing for all their software engineers when I think is they have to spend 1 day a week on their own private project.
Yeah.
I don't know how far that extends in the infrastructure, but if you could get in some way that they, because like someone at Google might find it interesting to do a private project of some kind about the education by Evoke, I mean, I don't know how, I don't know how it would, but if you could get a couple of people to think, maybe I'll spend my 1 day a week, that's at least helpful. I'm not sure how.
Could you see Google having any interest in an open net education project? Any self-interest? Not just because it sounds good, but would it be good for Google to have a flourishing open educational network?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
More internet traffic.
More net traffic is good for Google. More net traffic that's not copyright protected. Just more net traffic.
Sure, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Is there anything that would distinguish us, an educational enterprise, from any other enterprise that heightened net traffic? That is, have we got anything more to deliver than, I don't know what you'd call it. Hits.
Well, they say one of their things, they want to organize the world's information, and education is one of the big parts of making like data into information. And if they were in some way part of the kind of the structure of an open net, that would be fulfilling one of their goals. And I don't know whether that translates into cash in a direct sense, but it might be in the sense that it integrates them into another kind of information space that's just to develop it, and there might well be a market they can see even at some point in the future that we might want to be a part of.
Uh-huh. Yes, Dave.
They also have Google.org, which is the philanthropic arm of Google. And it says that the vision includes a commitment to devote employee time, 1% of the profits, towards philanthropy, with some hope of having a greater impact than Google itself. So they've got a stated mission that they've contributed. It looks like $90 million to begin with, and it raised this outside money, you know, with the entire purpose of kind of making a change in the world. And so the fact that they're dedicated to that and they've got money behind it and they're investing in companies that are kind of like promoting social change would seem to support the idea that if they like the idea of using poker as an educational tool, then they may get behind that in terms of funding it with Google.org or supporting an organization.
Yes.
I was just asking one of my friends who's at Google, and she said that she's never heard of it. She's been there over a year, Google University, and her boss has been there longer, and he's heard of it, but never actually. So I don't know if it's just different departments or higher ups, but if that's good for you to know, then.
No, I actually sent email about it several weeks ago to Zittrain, asking him. I think anything good back. Basically, it doesn't seem to be a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, this was the first time one of my friends had heard of it.
Right.
The thing I got, that was what I got out of it.
Yeah.
Not paying for speakers was that inside the company hierarchy, it must just not get a very big budget.
Can't have any budget.
I mean, I think that sometimes the value in these things is the ability to talk about it later, the ability to add it to the resume, particularly in terms of if you're viewing this as having a place within the corporate environment, or if you're attempting to talk to, down the line, talking to executive education or corporate education, having spoken at Google and having Google hosting you, because they're not really hosting you, is something that would go some way towards communicating towards business professionals that your teachings relate beyond the academia level and into the corporate world, which is what the value I saw from the farm.
Uh-huh.
It's one of those things that can be more valuable to talk about later than to actually do.
So what would you try and sell them, Andrew?
This meeting?
Yeah.
To me, what you say is less valuable than having gone there and done it. It gives you an entree.
So you wouldn't try and sell them on anything, you're just trying to amuse them.
Yeah.
Well, amuse yourself. The hell with that.
I mean, I would probably, if I was going in there, I would probably sell them on the power of the idea without necessarily trying to engage on any too specific, on a level that's extremely specific. I'd be attempting to offer them a teaser or something that would get them interested in the idea so that hopefully if there's somebody in that audience who has some sort of power or has some sort of interest within the company, then you'd be able to draw on that later, whether that's in access to the Google philanthropy, other Google resources, whether it's more corporate-oriented Google interests, whether that's simply access to more of the corporate world. I mean, we have a lot of access right now to the academic world. Corporate world, I feel like, is oftentimes suspicious of the relevance or the practical use of academia.
In a way, you're kind of relying on other people's ignorance about what it means to go speak to Google in order to sell it. Like, you're just pretty good at the idea that no one really finds out that it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, my friend at Google just Googled it on the Google internal site, and she said that nothing obvious came up about Google University. So.
Sounds like a small program within their thing, but if you could get them to tie it into, I don't know, maybe their partnership with Harvard writ large, then you can get them to pay for it if that's what you want.
And Google does, like university, you know, they sell their Gmail product to university to use as their email account, because that means they get to have every student get to Google. I mean, students are definitely a market for Google in that sense. And they definitely might be associated with universities.
I mean, when you write the press release for this, right? Are you going to write spoke at Google University, irrelevant to most of Google, or are you going to write spoke at Google to audience of software engineers, corporate advertisers, at the most dynamic company in the United States, filled with the smartest young people in the world?
So what are you going to write, Andrew?
I thought that was a fairly loaded question.
Well, I know, but I mean,
when I talk about the event.
And it's one of the things that I like us thinking about is the relationship between the actuality and what is said about it.
I've just found, like, they've got a sign, someone posted a picture of a sign from the Google University, and it's got four topics that are coming up. This is, one is the bicycle wheel. I think it looks like it's Google people generally from Google, talk to other people from Google. It says Google is teaching Googlers. It's an open source comprehensive history with gossip, theory and practice of cryptography, and you and your voice. And it seems like it's generally people with inside Google, talking to people inside Google, uh-huh. At least that's when it started. It might be a clue as to why there's not
uh-huh. All right, so here, can you read this? Is that big enough? Can you read that, actually? I can post it on the web here. I was asked to sign on to this today, and I thought that this was might prove an interesting point of departure for us. So there, I just put it up on the wiki. Read this and tell me if you were giving it a grade, what grade you would give it. Finish it? How many would give it an A? How many would give it an A minus? How many give it a B plus? How many give it a B? How many give it lower? So you basically think this is pretty good?
B plus is mediocre. At Harvard.
Mediocre. If we were going to say, would anybody call this excellent? Would anybody call it mediocre? All right. So tell us what's the matter with this. What's the problem? What are the problems? What don't you like? Well, let me stop that, actually. It's a wonderful rule, if you can possibly follow it in critique, to find what you like first. Is there anything you like in this? What do you like in this?
I like the part at the beginning, in the middle of the first paragraph, where it starts illegal downloading copyrighted material, should be discouraged wherever possible, curtailed, blah, 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 and however this provision does not address the issue. I like that part up until the end of the paragraph. But then I didn't like anything else.
That's the bit I didn't necessarily like. So I really like the beginning.
You like the beginning?
Boom. It kind of, you know, hits you in the face at the beginning.
Uh-huh. Boom, the Digital Freedom Academic Advisory Board strongly condemns the campus-based digital theft prevention provision of the College Opportunity and Affordability Act. Inclusion, yada, yada, is reprehensible. Did anybody find this interesting? How many found it interesting? How many found it boring? If you were really reading and you really came across this, you would have read to the bottom or you not, would have not?
I would have stopped at the second line.
Uh-huh.
What is the target audience for this piece?
What would you say the target audience is from reading this?
I'm just assuming it would be put out by this Digital Freedom Academic Advisory Board.
Just kind of put out.
Like a press release or something.
It's like we're speaking to the masses.
Well, I guess my criticism is there's not really an explanation of what this provision is. There's not enough detail. So the lay reader that doesn't know about this.
What is this thing? What did it do? What's so bad about it?
Yeah.
Well, it's reprehensible. I'm glad we know that the Digital Freedom Academic Advisory Board thinks so. Of course, we have no idea who the Digital Academic Freedom Advisory Board is. Has any of you ever heard of this organization before? Does it carry particular weight with you? So we're not really going to make this powerful on the basis of the character of the speaker, simply by naming an organization that nobody's ever heard of before. What do you think you've learned about the speaker from reading this? What would you say about the speaker? Not about the audience they're speaking to, but how would you describe the character of the speaker of this?
Vision, but I'm not really sure why.
So what you know is that about the speaker is that the speaker doesn't like the provision and doesn't really bother telling you why, but tells you that it's reprehensible.
Yeah.
It does tell you why, right?
I mean, it does tell you why.
I think it depends on which side of the issue you kind of come out on. I think Jenner and I have different opinions about the Act, and so as someone who thinks the Act is reprehensible, I think this gives good reasons.
I think it's reprehensible. I mean, but, you know, it's throwing out all these, like, jabs. Like, it runs counter to the legislative process. Like, why does it run counter to the legislative process? Like, why does it run counter to the best interests of our national institutions? Why does it run against the best interests of our students? It doesn't say any of that.
Yeah.
It seems like the speaker's complaining and criticizing, but there's no alternative offered.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, the part about consumer choice, like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, he's got a line, or she's got a line about consumer choice is the cornerstone of any successful strategy. I don't understand why that's the case. Like, what does consumer choice even mean in this context?
Picking which download service you're going to use instead of being forced to choose for, like,
but it's, I mean, for the lay reader, like.
I think it's just supposed to be like a blanket statement of their position. That's, I mean, personally, I don't think it says anything. That hasn't been said a million times before, but it's just kind of like saying we're the Digital Freedom Academic Advisory Board. But, I mean, I don't think you're trying to convert anybody with this. I think it's just somebody's posting something to make everybody aware that they exist, almost.
Okay, that's right. It doesn't seem to tell you as well why they would know better than anybody else, why they're more qualified to tell you that something reprehensible is going on. It just doesn't go into enough. It doesn't give you much to bite on.
Yeah, I felt really challenged when this came to me, in the sense that they're expecting me to come back to them and say either, yes, I'll sign on to this, or I'm sorry, I'd like you to restate it. But my restatement seems like it's going to be just a totally different statement. I can't tell for whom they're speaking. Whose interest are they protecting? Who's their client? And I can't tell who's their audience.
It seems almost like they're just, like this would run in, should run in the advertisement section of the New York Times as a big like advertisement, making people aware of the campus-based digital theft prevention provision of the College Opportunity and Affordability Act, because I think, I mean, I don't know many people who really, I was talking with a bunch of my cousins about it. Most of them didn't know about what was going on with all this now. And I think if you got it generally, like, made this general knowledge to people, they'd be kind of outraged about it. I'm hoping that's what they're trying to do, because I don't see them being very effective at doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Is the fact they're asking you to sign, you're trying to imply that you're in some way involved with the Digital Freedom Act and Advisory Board?
Well, let me describe the background of this to you, because, again, it's got qualities of what we're talking about here. The group, there's the guy who writes this, Vijay, is a paid staff lobbyist for the consumer electronics industry. The consumer electronics industry has taken the trouble to budget and pay for staff who've taken the trouble to assemble an advisory group of academics and then convene a conversation amongst them by telephone, leading to the drafting of a statement meant to be issued in common over the signatures of the academics. But the draft is actually put together by a lobbyist. So a publicist with a client.
Scheduled something, thought they were going to handle in this room and send out an email.
Huh.
The second guy we've got in here today.
Yeah.
There's a sign on the door that says something's been moved.
Huh.
I think he said Indian gaming.
Yeah.
So in a sense, this guy is trying to think in our Cyber One terms. He's trying to figure out how to advance an argument and get uptake on it. And he's willing to take the trouble of actually trying to write a draft and see if he can sign people up to it. And if it came out successfully, it would come out pretty much like what you're saying. You know, you'd see it in the newspaper and it'd have a bunch of names on it. And you'd say, oh, yeah, well, look at that. But interesting to ask, actually, why would the consumer electronics industry be interested in spending its money on that?
Well,
imagine, because the largest retailer of digital music right now is iTunes, and iTunes has proprietary DRM. I don't know if Apple is part of this lobby group, but I would imagine not. And all its competitors want to do whatever they can to stop the rise of a single major DRM provider, which is to say Apple.
It could be as well that consumer electronics generally there to make the assumption of copyrighted material, or what is it now, copyrighted material. So if you say consumer electronics is MP3 players, TVs, it seems like everything's going to have an internet connection, and therefore they might have an interest in there being more freely available information or material in their devices.
So why shouldn't the argument somehow be cast in real terms? I mean, Xander, your suggestion actually sounds like it's grounded in self-interest of the consumer electronics industry.
I think lobby groups generally are grounded in such things.
Right. And they're worried about this law affecting the market in a way that is going to be bad for their business. It somehow feels it would be stronger if that was stated, and if they then stated other reasons, but it feels somehow weaker to hold back on the real argument and to have this guy trying to articulate arguments that are not the consumer electronic industry's arguments.
It's a little nebulous, right, coming from the Digital Freedom Academic Advisory Board.
Uh-huh.
I think they need to catch a name that spells something out in acronym. And I think their best move, actually, as far as I'm concerned, is not even to go into all these arguments about why that provision is so horrible, but just explain what that provision is. And don't worry about convincing people that it's a bad idea, because if you tell people what it actually does, I think the majority of people will be like, that's a horrible, horrible idea. And you won't have to convince them, because it's just something that they're going to look at. They're not going to look at it and be like, oh, let's not give money to kids who want to go to school because somebody downloaded a song on the university's network. It's a ridiculous provision on its face. You don't have to convince people of that.
Well, maybe that's the way to go. All right, tomorrow, Jihad, you're ready? And Xander?
Yes, sir.
And Syed?
I require that Xander doesn't put too much more time into this, because I have a feeling it's going to be better than mine.
These things are intensely competitive.
He's an undergrad kid, he gets like that.
Yeah, it's true.
They're smart.
It's true.